You may be aware that relatively recently a prominent Premiership footballer was found guilty in a court of law of criminal sexual behaviour with an underage girl. It was featured on the television news. There was one event in connection with that, that as I looked at it on the television set, I cringed. It was something that happens relatively often. A reporter was following this fellow as he approached the courtroom, and I can't remember his exact words, but he said something like, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself for your disgusting behavior, Mr. whatever his name was?" And I cringed because I absolutely despise, as I'm sure you do, the glee with which the media pursues and grinds into the dirt under their heel people who have been caught out in sin. And you think, but don't you have any sins of your own? And as we look at David's sin today in 2 Samuel chapter 11, your inward response will be very revealing. Will it be a kind of angry, self-righteous accusation? How could he behave in that way? Letting down so many people. Or will it, on the other hand, be that experience where that sort of icy hand grips your heart as you realize, but that could so easily be me. And in many respects has been. So we come to 2 Samuel chapter 10. It's a thoroughly familiar passage. I'm not going to say anything this morning that you don't already know. My reassurance in opening my mouth and speaking familiar things is that while these truths are familiar, we need to hear them again and again, and they always find us in a different set of circumstances from the last time we heard them. And so if the truth remains unchanging and familiar, it can come with a fresh power as it finds us perhaps in a set of spiritual circumstances that are different, maybe more precarious than last time you read this chapter and heard these words. So we're going to proceed then this morning under four headings. The first is good people may sin seriously. Good people may sin seriously. Now you know that David is essentially a man of God. And if you've been with us last week, you will know that in the immediate context and the outline that I gave you of chapter 10, that the author of 2 Samuel has deliberately drawn our attention to David's godliness. Why do I say that? Well, remember that before his sin, David, chapter 9, is marked as a man carries out chesed. That's the Hebrew word for covenant love. Chesed is what God has towards his people when he enters into a covenant relationship with them. It's a Hebrew term that may be translated in a variety of ways: kindness, loving kindness, steadfast love, and it captures the two ideas of love and of loyalty that arise normally within a covenant relationship. It's the way that God is towards us. It's the way that David was aware that God was towards him. And as we saw last week, a godly person reflects and echoes what God is like. How has God behaved towards me? Well, then I respond in a similar way and treat others in that way. And that's what our author goes out of his way to show us that David is like. He is a godly man. He behaves in a chesed way, first of all, chapter 9 towards Mephibosheth, showing him, and the NIV has the word, the translation, kindness. That's what David is like. When you come to chapter 10, it's interesting that you find that David here again shows chesed, this time towards even more unlikely people, foreigners. So chapter 10 and verse 2, David thought, I will show kindness, there's that word, to Hanun, son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. It seems to be in a two-way street. So David sent a delegation to express his sympathy to Hanun concerning his father. Who is this David? King David, a man after God's own heart, a godly man, a man who reflects God's conduct towards him. He shows love and loyalty towards Mephibosheth and even towards foreigners. What a remarkable thing. What a remarkable man. What a conspicuously godly man. A man in a conspicuously important position as king of Israel, as leader of the people of God, as God's anointed king over this Old Testament manifestation of God's kingdom. And then you come to chapter 11 and there's this abrupt change. It's this man who acts in a way, in more or less a moment, that is in flat and outright contradiction to his normal character. Among all of the other sins, he commits adultery, which is the quintessential non-chesed way of living, isn't it? Marriage is the human illustration of God's covenant with us, where two people vow to behave towards each other in love and in loyalty. And here David enters into a relationship with a woman that violates his own, well, marriages, therein lies another story, but that violates her marriage as well. That this man whose life was so built around covenant loyalty and love violates it in our chapter. He's a good man who sins seriously. He can't say, well, it's not sin because I'm a good man. And since I'm a good man, it's not possible for me to sin. No, it's possible for a good man absolutely to contradict himself. So Darav Davis, in his customary incisiveness, says, here, the previous chapters, is David acting kindly and loyally. There, chapter 11, is David throwing kindness and loyalty to the winds. Here is David controlled by his covenants and his memories. There is David driven by his glands and his secrets. Here, David spares and mourns life. There, he tramples and destroys life. It's a shocking contradiction, but it happened. It's sad to say that there are numerous examples and illustrations one could give of such a decline. One example is of a hymn writer whose hymn we're going to sing when I'm finished. Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace, streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise, teach me some melodious measure, sung by flaming tongues above, oh the vast, the boundless treasure of my Lord's unchanging love. The author of that hymn was Robert Robinson. In 1752, as a 17-year-old young lad, he went to listen to George Whitefield preach, and he was deeply affected. 6 years later, he composed that very hymn. He became a Baptist pastor. He had a fine intellect, apparently, and was an able preacher. One day, he was traveling in a stagecoach with other people, and there was a woman who was a fellow passenger. She was a stranger, and she was going over the hymns that she had found to be a great blessing, as one does in 17 in the 1750s, and she referred repeatedly to "Come thou fount of every blessing." She didn't know that she was with the author of that hymn, Robert Robinson, and he could not contain his agitation. He said, and these are his words, "Madam, I am the poor unhappy man who composed that hymn many years ago, and I would give a thousand worlds if I had them to enjoy the feelings I had then." Why? What had happened in the meantime? He confessed that toward the end of his life he had given way to frivolous habits. And when we sing that hymn, you will see how prophetic it is of his own experience. "Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it." One of many, many sad examples of a good, talented, respected, gifted person who sinned. What do we do with this information? Don't trust yourself. Don't ever think, "I'm a Christian, a New Testament Christian. That only happened in the Old Testament. It can't happen to me." Yes, it can. Don't ever think, "It can't happen to me because I have a fine reputation. I take a lead in the church. I'm essentially not capable of sinning like this, of contradicting myself from one day to the next. It would be so out of character." Never, never think that about yourself. That is a fatal, fatal self-confidence. And if you do, you will make very, very painful discoveries about your capacity to sin in the way that David did. And so, I cringe, and I hope you cringe, when you see the media gleefully chasing somebody who's fallen, as though it will never happen to that individual. Oh yes, it could. There's only one who is good enough to be utterly consistent throughout the course of all of his life, never one day contradicting the previous day. There's only one who's ever been like that perfectly. Only one who is superior to King David and who qualifies to be a king over us. Jesus, who was always good and never sinned, and upon whom we must cling in order to find the grace never to fall as David did. Good people may sin seriously. Never, ever think that you are above it. Never be Mr. Daredevil who says, "I can go 100 miles an hour, 6 inches away from the cliff edge. That's how confident I am in myself and in my ability." Rather be can't even remember what the other fellow's name is. Mr. What did I? There we are. You were listening, Mr. Safety First. "I don't trust myself next to the cliff edge. I will stay as far, far away from it as I can." Good people may sin seriously. Secondly, sin thrives in a vacuum. Sin thrives in a vacuum, of neglected duty. What are the circumstances? Well, chapter 10. Sketches the circumstances. Israel was at war with the Ammonites. And this war, I remind you, had arisen because of a diplomatic outrage. And so Israel's army ranged against the Ammonites. And Joab takes the fight to the Ammonites, and in verse 1 of chapter 11, "In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem." And you can tell that that "but" is introducing something that David shouldn't have been doing. He stayed in Jerusalem when he should have been discharging his responsibility. What was his duty? Well, if we don't really have time to do it, but to jump ahead to 2 Samuel chapter 12 from verse 36 onwards, you finally get to a description of what David does in the end that he should have been doing now. It was his duty as king to strike the final blow. So Joab, who's the chief of staff, who's the general, who's over the armies, is laying siege against the Ammonites, and so David should have been there as king. He should have led the victorious forces under the unfurled banner of the Israelites. He should have received the honor, and he should have been the one who reduced the captive Ammonites to forced labour, but where was he? He was at home. He hadn't bothered to do that. He didn't take up his responsibilities. David did not take up his duty, and it's evident that in the vacuum that was created by the failure to take up his duty, that there was this opportunity for sin. And I think that the important thing here, as it applies to us, is David's state of mind. Undoubtedly, he might have been in the full course of pursuing his duty and inadvertently spotted the beautiful woman bathing. How you respond to that depends on your frame of mind, doesn't it? And if you're on the frame of mind that is, in other respects, generally one of laxness in relation to duty, you have surely opened yourself up to that temptation becoming a serious possibility of sinning. A general attitude of neglect, particularly of spiritual duties, but of general duties, is surely a kind of a spiritual greenhouse in which the little plants of temptation flourish and become weeds of sin. And there are clearly reasons for that, because the neglect of duty leaves you with time, doesn't it, to get up to mischief. The neglect of duty is a state of mind then which pervades the whole of your life and makes you spiritually ripe for sin. I know from my own experience, if you aren't praying, if you aren't reading your Bible, if you aren't visiting the lonely, if you aren't keeping up the diligent habit of attending the prayer meeting, then there's something in your experience that's going on that is accommodating a laxness, an attitude towards duty that is spiritually unhealthy. That is a state of mind in a set of circumstances that is absolutely ripe for you to fall prey to temptation that comes across your path. And in contrast, isn't it true, and I'm sure you know this again from your own experience, that pursuing ardently and energetic what you know to be right is in itself creates a frame of mind and a general restraint from doing what is sinful and wrong. Isn't that right? I can just remember how when I was at university at that time, I was a young Christian and I was just wanting to serve God. So when my classmates were going off and doing this and that, it had no appeal to me because there was me and Wolfie and John, and we were on Sunday, we were going up to this little rural church and we wanted to preach to them and do it well, and so we were studying and working out how we would do it. I don't want to vaunt myself, I have enough sin to know that I'm not a great example, but I just, that very vividly, how the Lord helped to preserve me from falling into the kinds of things you can easily fall into at university, because I had other things on my mind that were much more wholesome. So that pursuing what is right with all of your heart is itself a wonderful restraint. That's not what David was doing. Sin thrives in a vacuum. So there may be a stronger link, I'm saying to you, between failing in spiritual disciplines and adultery, deceit, and murder. A closer link than you realize. Sin thrives in a vacuum. Number three, sin proceeds rapidly. Sin proceeds rapidly. This is perhaps true particularly of sexual sin as we encounter it here, but I think surely there's some general principles here. Dermot Davis quotes a fellow by the name of Brueggemann, who describes what's going on here. He says, "The action is quick. The verbs rush as the passion of David rushed. He sent, he took, he lay. The royal deed of self-indulgence does not take very long. There is no adornment to the action. The action is so stark. There is nothing but action. There's no conversation. There's no hint of caring, of affection, of love, only lust.
David does not call her by name, does not even speak to her. It's quick. That morning David woke up the man of chapters 9 and 10. That night he went to bed an adulterer. Quick. The descent is rapid. It's urgent. It's interesting, again, the commentators point out that we have here just a description of the deed that was done, of the actions that took place, and there's no reflection on what was the state of mind, because that's largely irrelevant. So there's no comment on inner feelings. Was Bathsheba baiting David? We're not told. Did she resent what he did? We're not told. Did David go through an enormous internal turmoil and wrestling? We're not told about that. All we know is that sin happened precipitously. He acted thoughtlessly. He didn't reflect, we're not told this, but we must assume it, on what he was doing, on what the consequences would be. It just was this led to that in quick succession. I remind you then that there is a general principle and lesson to learn. The first step is surely the most dangerous. And we never fully bargain for the outcome when we dally with the first thought. We think we are still in control and we will keep sin at an arm's length, and the second step will not necessarily follow the first. But the reality is different, as it was with David, that this good man in one step plunges over the cliff edge, and what started with a look ended up with adultery and murder. Sin proceeds rapidly. We are not in control of temptation as we think we are. And we need, by God's grace, to hate sin and to be cautious. Number four, sin always has consequences. Sin always has consequences. Now, I'm sure that I'm not only speaking for myself, that I can include you when I say that we all gamble foolishly on consequence-free sinning, don't we? And for a while, David probably felt that actually this time he had achieved that, consequence-free sinning. It was all going well until some unwanted news came from Bathsheba, verse 5. I am pregnant. Well, that's a pretty literal way in which David's sin had consequences. But it's a reminder that the same is true of all sin. That the idea of consequence-free sinning is a myth. With sexual sin, the consequences may be stark. Pregnancy, ruined reputation and relationships. But all sin has consequences. And here I just want to spend our remaining time looking at some of the consequences that arose in David's experience. The first is the temptation, the next temptation to which he yielded, to cover up. And of course, that's the bulk of the chapter, from verse 6 on to around verse 25. Because the options are stark when you've sinned, aren't they? It's either confession or cover up. Those are the alternatives. Confession or cover up. And confession is always the right way to go. I'm sure you've reflected on this, that you think, I've sinned. My sin is fresh. I know it was wrong, but perhaps I should just leave some time in order to get some distance between me and my guilt, and then in good conscience I can confess. But our confession, though it may seem hypocritical to us, ought to be immediate. Immediate, because our options are confession or cover-up. You may still have the blood of your deed on your hands. You may still have its taste in your mouth. You may still have the images vivid in your brain. And as the Holy Spirit convicts you of your sin, then and there, as hypocritical as it may feel to you at the time, you must confess, because your only alternatives are confession or cover-up. And David chose to cover up. That's what this whole chapter, the bulk of this chapter is about. How did he do it? Well, if we trace the route, we will find that David's attempts to cover up, of course, just spectacularly compound the problem and add sin to sin. The initial attempt, verses 6 to 11, is he gives Uriah a weekend pass. So Uriah, the plan is, will come home, he'll spend time with his wife, and everyone will think that Uriah is the father of the unborn child and David isn't, but it didn't work. So there's a next, more determined attempt, verses 12 and 13. David extends Uriah's pass, entertains him, gets him drunk, tries to manipulate him so that he would show less restraint and spend time with his wife. No, he doesn't. That didn't work. So verses 14 to 25 is this brazen stratagem of the plan to get Uriah killed so that David then can legitimately marry Bathsheba and therefore legitimately in the appearance to others of being the child's father. That stratagem did work, but it was murder. And so David's experience here illustrates, of course, that the consequence to sinning is first of all the temptation to cover up and so compound sin. Face up to the stark alternatives. Deal with your sin or add to it. Confess it or cover it up. Second consequence in David's case was the hardening of his heart. The hardening of his heart. Because covering up sin, which he chose to do instead of confess it, leads to hardness of heart. We can follow the development of his hardening heart. If you have a look at verse 11, Uriah's example, surely we might say, is enough to soften David, to break his heart. Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." He's a godly man. He's a principled man. He can't take pleasure while his comrades are fighting. Isn't that enough? The example of his principled behavior, enough to send the arrows of conscience and conviction straight to David's heart, to expose to himself his sin. Daroth Davis again says that Uriah's speech here is a speech expressing the acme of devotion, and shows that this Hittite, remember he's a Hittite, that this Hittite is the only genuine Israelite in the whole chapter. Isn't that enough to convict him? Isn't that enough to break his heart? Isn't that enough to say this Hittite is behaving this way and I'm the king of Israel? No, he's unmoved. Sin is beginning to have its hardening effect. You look on to verses 14 and 15, and the obvious evil of his plot doesn't stop him in his tracks. He is resorting to planning murder. But the way that he does it, he makes the victim, Uriah, unwittingly carry his own death warrant. He's holding the piece of paper that is the instruction to his commanding officer to put him in the fiercest field of battle so that he will die. Isn't that enough to convict David? I don't know if they had mirrors in those days. Maybe it was just polished metal. But in that, after he'd done that, when he looked in the mirror, couldn't he see a murderer? How could he face himself? Can't he see how far he's fallen? It was adultery and deceit, and now he's plotting the death of a godly and an innocent man. Can't he see that his life has descended into the equivalent of a plot of a cheap novel? Doesn't conscience at this point in time awaken within him and tell him, stop, now is the time to bring an end to all of this, confess your sin? Won't he at this point in time say, I've committed adultery, but I won't stoop to this? No, he ploughs on. And his heart gets harder. Move down to verse 25, and you find that at this point in time, he will not even stop at blaming God for his own sin. Remember how he dismisses Joab with the explanation, well, the sword devours one as well as another. In other words, in the providence of God, these things happen. When you're fighting for your country, it can happen that you find yourself in the thick of battle and you fall. That's what happens in battle. The providence of God. We can't explain it. It's a mystery. When he knows that it's a consequence of his own deliberate action, and he's glad in the outcome, he's begun to blame God when he is guilty. How hard his heart has become. When you look at how this story unfolds, you find that this covering up rather than confessing persists for about a year. The child is born before David is brought to confession. So it's been going on, this hardening of heart and not owning up to his sin for at least 9 months. Perhaps a year has gone by, a whole year. Think of what you were doing a year ago. A whole year of unconfessed sin, of persisting in covering up. Think of what's dried up within the mind and heart and soul of David. Think of the relationship with God to which he has given such rich expression in the Psalms. And that's deserted him. If Psalm 32 is his reflection on this experience and his ultimate confession, then verses 3 to 4 will be describing what he's going through. When I kept silent, in other words, when I didn't confess, when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy on me, my strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. I lost all appetite for spiritual things. I didn't want to worship God with God's people. The prayer meeting no longer had any appeal for me. I started to think, how did I ever find any pleasure in those things? Now when I go along, it's dry and I have no engagement with what's going on. That's where he was in his heart. Heavy towards God. Sluggish in spiritual things. No energy to serve him. That became the norm. And he forgot that life could be any different. We have a New Testament description of this in Hebrews chapter 3 from verse 12. Take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God, but encourage one another day after day, as long as it is called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. That was David's experience. Now that brings us to the end of the chapter, and that brings us to the end of this part of the story, but it's not the end of David's experience, because we shall see, God willing, on the next occasion, that God will not let one of his children go. That God is utterly tenacious and relentless in grace in holding on to one of his people. And though David has sinned seriously, repeatedly, persistently, and over a long period of time, that is insufficient to turn God away from him. And God will get him back. And he will do so by his normal route, That is, he sends Nathan the prophet to speak a convicting word to David's conscience and heart, so that David is awakened to the awful reality of his spiritual plight, and he is brought to the place that is so beautifully articulated in Psalm 51 of confession before God, and that is described again in retrospect in Psalm 32. So you may be here this morning, and this description of David is your description of your experience. Might have managed to cover it up and conceal it from others. Might even have managed to sort of hang on to your Christian and church responsibilities, and you've kept them going, at least in order to save face, although the life and the heart has been sucked out of it. And you might be right here this morning and say, well, all that you've been describing is very, very true of me. It's not the end of the story. It doesn't need to be the end of the story, because there is grace. And if you want to short-circuit the account and not wait until next week, then on your own go straight to Psalm 51 and make that your confession. It's full of brokenheartedness, but it's full of hope. It's resulted in Psalm 32. How blessed is the man against whom God does not impute his iniquity. And the language, the vocabulary that that David uses there is not just sin and iniquity. The NIV doesn't really have it. I think it's the NASB has it. Iniquity, perversion. So that David, when he finally got to confessing his sin, he called it by its right name. And he came to the marvelous discovery that though he had been guilty of iniquity, of twisted perversion, that he came to the place where God did not account it against him. God did not hold it against him. God brought him to the place where his sin problem was solved. And he reached again, recovered the place of personal blessedness, so that he could rejoice and sing songs of praise. So the Lord can do that for you too. That's the gospel. That however precipitously you have fallen, however far, however rapidly, however much you have lingered and your conscience has become hardened and your heart hardened, there is still the way of recovery. And for us it could not be clearer, since we are able to look into the face of the Lord Jesus Christ, in whom is revealed the full extent of God's mercy towards sinners. But if you're tempted to rationalize and excuse and explain away and to say, but it was reasonable for me to behave that way, I was lonely, I was depressed, then take note of the closing words of the chapter. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord, or one of the other translations, but the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. In the Old Testament narrative, very often you have the record of what happens, but you have no, the author doesn't give a judgment about whether it was right or wrong, and you sometimes left scratching your head. Did he do the right thing? Did he do the wrong thing? Before we get to the end of the chapter, we've guessed pretty much that David has done the wrong thing. That's pretty clear. But the point is that David is busy covering this up so that other people won't find out and see. And here is the note that tells us that the one person's view that matters is this. The cover-up hasn't worked. The thing David had done was evil in the Lord's eyes. He's more or less, up till now, kind of got away with it in relation to others and his reputation, but he hasn't got away with it with God. Lord, help us to go straight to confession and find the blessedness of sins dealt with, sins forgiven, sins washed away, of the Lord's heavy hand lifted away from us, so that we can be free to serve Him again with full, energetic, spiritual hearts. The only place where a real Christian is happy.